Hi, podcast listener. How's it going? Today's show, you'll notice, is a little shorter than usual. That's because it's our winter pledge drive. And if you listen to Good Food via podcast, you probably haven't heard me and my colleagues begging and pleading for your support on air. So I'll keep this short and just give you my quick pitch. Think about the word curated. It gets bandied about a lot these days. And in our ever-exploding world of food information, having a curated listening experience is a good thing. I've always said that the great strength of good food is our cross-category love. Recipes? We have those. Food politics and environmental issues? Check. But we're also total suckers for the oddball, the hilarious, and the just plain strange. For those are the stories that manage to reveal our quirky humanness through food. That's why you love us. We're hard to pin down, and we manage to consistently deliver just the bite you want to digest. So if you haven't already joined, consider listening to Good Food as a member. We've made it so easy to do. Just call 1-800-600-KCRW. That's 800-600-5279. Or go online to kcrw.com/join. I'm a member. And if you haven't already, join me in supporting the programming that you rely on each week. Thank you. Now let's get to the show. From KCRW and kcrw.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today, how not to fear the souffle.
Under this golden dome lies an uncooked, unrisen, unbaken souffle, waiting patiently for the oven. It's going to fit my time schedule, not vice versa. See how to be the big boss of the big cheese souffle. Today, on The French Chef.
Souffle. Even the word sounds like what it is. A big puff of air containing sexy deliciousness. So why are we so scared of them? Greg Patton learned how to make souffle watching Julia Child. He's here today to continue her legacy and tell us how to be the big boss of the big cheese souffle. His forthcoming book in the French Cook series is simply titled Souffles. Hi.
Hi.
Soufflés really fascinate me because they're one of those dishes that really rely on the mastery of a few techniques.
Just about two. Whipping egg whites properly. And when I say properly, to the stiffness that they should get to before you do the next technique, which is folding them in or incorporating them into the base. The base of a soufflé holds all of the flavor. And then the whites basically are what you need to actually lift the soufflé up in the oven.
Describe for me the perfect texture of a finished soufflé.
Well, I would say light. Velvety. The texture should be velvety, and there should be a creamy quality to the souffle itself. Typically, if you make a cheese souffle, it's very simple to do that. If you're going to be incorporating things into the souffle, like candied fruits for a dessert souffle, it's going to have a different texture. But basically, you want a velvety smoothing. And so if you're making a strawberry souffle, for example, or a passion fruit souffle, you can achieve that really well. And a chocolate souffle especially is really easy to achieve in terms of the smoothness of it.
So let's talk about the base first. Is the base always the same?
No. The base is not always the same. And, traditionally, and I learned how to make soufflés watching Julia Child, and she would always use a bechamel base and then egg yolks beaten into that. And then you could add cheese into that. This is for a savory. And if you weren't adding cheese, if you didn't make a savory, after you had your egg yolks incorporated into your bechamel, then you could add a flavoring like melted chocolate or Grand Marnier or something like that. And then you would beat your whites and fold them in, and then you would bake it in the oven. And one thing about souffles is that they don't have to be baked immediately. Most of them can sit on the counter for at least an hour or two. Just cover them up with an overturned pot. They can be refrigerated for a couple of hours. And one of the best things about soufflés is that you can freeze the unbaked soufflé for a couple of weeks. Make sure that you wrap it securely after it's totally frozen. Take it out of the freezer about a half hour before you want to bake it, which means turning on your oven to preheat. And then you bake your souffle for just a little bit longer than you should, because it's still partially frozen. And they will puff up just as high as if you had just made them.
I had no idea.
And I didn't either until I read Madeline Kamen. and she's the one who turned me on to that.
I want to go back to the base for a second. So mm-hmm. if bechamel is not always the base, then what else is?
It could be just the food itself, like the vegetable or the fruit. I can make a pineapple souffle, for example, with just the fruit. I can make a fennel souffle just by cooking up some fennel and pureeing it. There's also a something called a bouilli base, which is just the milk and flour that's cooked. There's no butter in it at this point. And then you have the option of adding a little bit of butter after it's cooked. And then you can add your egg yolks and your flavoring if you want. But each base, I think, has a particular function for a particular souffle.
So with the savory souffle, you're not adding sugar. And sugar actually helps the whites form the matrix so they don't start to collapse on themselves and the water separates
out. That's right, right. Sugar is a stabilizer.
So if you're making a savory souffle, what are some techniques that we need to learn or tips to look out for to really make those whites as beautiful as we need them to be?
What you want to do is not overbeat the whites. When the whites are ready to be folded into the souffle base for a savory souffle, then they should have a very creamy look. They should be shiny. And when you use a rubber spatula to lift some whites out of the bowl, they should hold just a peak that barely holds its shape. It can actually curl over a little bit.
Do we use cream of tartar?
Yes. Cream of tartar is excellent to use. I use it in all of my souffles routinely, because it does stabilize the whites.
Okay, let's talk about the vessel in which we're pouring our souffle mix. Do we always need to use what we think of now as the classic white, ridged porcelain souffle dish?
No. I've used everything from like a coffee mug to a skillet. Basically, use anything that you have on hand. You don't, and a pie plate will work as well. Even for a dessert souffle, you just spoon it out of the pie plate.
So timing the souffle and knowing when it's done. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've had the experience of the appearance of it. It's beautiful. It's mm-hmm. risen. I have this beautiful golden top. I take it out. I stick the spoon in and it's soup.
Well, then you didn't bake it enough. And the way to test, actually, and this is particularly true, I think, of the larger souffles, the center is always the last to get done. And you'll see it's always lovely and brown. But if you see a depression in the center, if the center isn't as high as the sides, chances are you're going to have to leave it in longer. But the best test is to take a wooden skewer and just insert it into the thickest part of the souffle, and the skewer should come out clean. But if it's wet, then it could end up, as you say, like soup.
Greg, this has been just so much fun. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you.
Greg Patton's forthcoming book is Souffles. If you want to impress your loved one this Valentine's Day with a classic cheese souffle, we've got Greg's recipe on our blog. Plus, we've got an extended interview there with plenty of souffle cooking tips and myth busters. Check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's that moment we all look forward to each week. Jonathan Gold is here. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and a weekly fixture here on Good Food. This week, he's taking us to Macaroni Republic, an Italian restaurant run by industry veterans Antonio Tomasi and Jean-Louis Demori.
The focus is really sort of almost monomaniacally on pasta. And there are a few appetizers, and you'll probably end up ordering one of them if you go. They have a really nice polpettine of shrimp, which is thin meatballs, fried patties of chopped shrimp that they serve with sort of sweet and sour onions.
Oh, that sounds great.
Everybody has fried calamari, but their fried calamari are especially good. Tomasi does his own version of I always pronounce this wrong, Nduja?
No, it's perfect.
Oh, good. Which is the spreadable, super hot sausage from Calabria that was something that people in L.A. just aspired to try one day, you know, 10 years ago, and now suddenly it's in a lot of places. But his version is really good. And something that I think a lot of people are going to end up getting, which is the – they call it the Violetta di Melanzane, which is basically the eggplant parm of your dreams.
Wow.
You know, eggplant and lots of mozzarella and a really nice tomato sauce.
So let's talk about the main thing, the pastas.
They're all fresh pasta. They're all made in-house, obviously. I mean, they've been talking about opening a small noodle factory behind the restaurant, and maybe they'll end up doing that. It would be nice. Probably the best known and maybe the one you should go for if you go is the agnolotti, like, you know, small little stuffed pasta, stuffed with ossobuco. You get sort of that melting veal shank texture when you bite into it and the flavor of the herbs, and it's served in a salsa verde instead of the sort of heavy tomato sauce or the butter and sage that you might expect. It's a really nice dish. There's the richness of the meat, but also the sort of sharpness of it.
Mmm, yum.
There's a very decent, if traditional, lasagna with meat sauce and bechamel. There's potato gnocchi with mushrooms. There's one of the better versions I've had recently of just simple, you know, spaghetti with seafood. The sauce is nicely acidic. It has like a sharpness to it. The seafood is super fresh. You're not going to find an old mussel or a freezer burned shrimp. Just comes together nicely. It's not a complex dish, but it's a dish you want to have. This is probably the part where I should mention that it's pretty inexpensive. I mean, the pastas like start at, you know, $9 for pasta and tomato sauce, and they go up to about $15 for something with a lot of seafood.
That's shocking in this day and age where $16 will often get you a very, very small portion of a pasta.
It is. And you bring your own wine. I mean, so far they don't have a beer and wine license, so that's another cost that you don't have. Nobody's really expecting you to get an appetizer, though it's nice if you do. So it's a place where you can just drop by on a Tuesday night with a couple of friends and get out probably for $50 or $60.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic.
It's really good. And a lot of it is patio, opening onto sort of this passageway between Spring Street and Broadway. It feels like a trattoria in a way that a lot of restaurants in L.A. don't. In fact, probably it feels more like a trattoria than any place I've ever been here. The sort of place where you sit, you talk with friends, you drink wine of your own choosing, and, you know, waiters or waitresses come by with big trays with four things of the same pasta that they plop down on tables. It's casual. People go there to sort of be with each other, and the fact that there's really good food there is almost secondary. It's nice.
That is really nice. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Macaroni Republic on Broadway between 3rd and 4th Streets in downtown L.A. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. Just text the words Good Food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food restaurant map, which is on the Good Food blog. I don't know if you've noticed, but chefs are kind of cauliflower crazed right now. If you are too, well, then you're in luck. It's beautiful at Southern California markets right now. Laura Avery's at the Farmers Market, where chefs and home cooks both are shopping for peak season winter vegetables.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. In the dead of winter, we are always looking for new things to cook with, and we turn to local author Amelia Salzman, who wrote the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, who's here, as always, at the markets, sussing out good things to cook with. Amelia, what's really seasonal right now, and what's delicious to make?
Well, this is the height of cauliflower season. You know, we think we can get it all year long, and that's true. But they are the sweetest right now because of the cold weather. I particularly love roasting it. Now, I have one little secret. You need to blanch it first. Break it up into whatever size you want, and you need to cook it in boiling salted water for 2 to 3 minutes, and then rinse it, get rid of that sulfurous water, you know, chill it down if you want to, and then do whatever else you want, including roasting. So I know that sounds like an extra step, but it's actually a convenience for a couple of reasons. One is that it can be like you can do it ahead and then just roast off anything you want later. Also, it is a convenience because the end product is going to be much more wonderful and roast more quickly. And three, you're just going to get rid of any off odors that sometimes happen with cabbages and cauliflowers and broccolis by doing that one little step. So you've blanched the cauliflower and turn up the oven to about 400 degrees, pat the cauliflower dry, and toss it with olive oil and salt. You can add any number of seasonings if you like at this point or not, but you could do paprika, pimenton, which is a smoked paprika, curry powder, anything like that would be fine. Toss it together on a sheet pan, throw it in the oven, give it a toss about 15 minutes into the cooking time, another 15 minutes, and you should have really nicely caramelized, browned cauliflower. Once you get the cauliflower out of the oven, you can serve it just as is, or you can go any number of ways. You can do a wonderful salsa verde, a parsley sauce. You could toss the hot cauliflower with grated Parmesan cheese right out of the oven so that it kind of sticks to the, oh, it's just wonderful. It lends itself to tossing with raisins and cilantro and parsley, so you get hot peppers, so you get these sort of wonderful flavors.
Right, giving it its due respect.
Indeed.
All right, Amelia. Well, that is a wonderful base recipe that we can just add to and enjoy and take advantage of this very plentiful vegetable. So thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That was Amelia Salzman. She's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, helping us to enjoy cauliflower even more. One of the items that is most seasonally affected and hardest to source is the wild mushrooms that we have at the farmer's market, brought in by David West through his Clearwater Farm. And David, your foragers are up in the mountains. You're in communication with them. I do see you have truffles on your table right now. What is the season now? What should we be expecting to see, and how's the dry weather affecting that?
All right, well, we'll take them one at a time. It is truffle season. It usually starts around the end of November, and then they run till about the end of February, so we're nearing the end. The nice thing about truffles, they get better every week until the season finally ends. They don't peak and drop off. So we do still have both black and white, and they're not too highly affected by the drought. They grow fairly deep underground. I would think that the drought would have more of an effect next year. But as far as the weather affecting the wild mushroom crop, the guys who pick for me and for themselves, but have had to move much farther north than they ever did before. And what that means is they're going to pick in areas that is not their home turf, so to speak. So they have people upset with them, same as they get upset when people come in and try to pick in their patches. And they're also not as successful. They don't have area. They don't know where to go. And they know basically what to look for. And all the pickers are being concentrated into this one little area. You go too far north, and it's much too wet and cold. And if you go really south of, south of Arcata, it's dry. Mendocino County is dry. And going down the road, in the springtime, we get morels and we get fresh porcini in mid-May till the end of June. And it's really one of our most popular products. They typically will grow in the mountains and they follow the snow melt. And that's what prolongs the season. there is no snow. So yes, they'll pop in the spring, but anything from 3,000 feet to 5,000 or 6,000 feet are all going to grow at the same time. And that's really only if we get spring rains. It's hard to imagine we won't get some rain at some point. But the idea of snow melting back slowly and having a crop from mid-May till the end of June, I have zero hope of that happening.
This is specifically for the morels and the porcinis, which are the wonderful, spring crop.
Yes, the fresh porcini, primarily, more so than the morels. We haven't had a decent morel crop in I don't know how long, so it's sad.
Yeah.
But, the drought is a problem. And where I live, up in the Santa Barbara County, the lake is just, it's remarkably empty.
All right, David. Well, thank you so much. And the truffles will be here a couple more weeks.
A couple more weeks.
Free whiffs of the box if you don't want to buy one. That wonderful smell.
You can be 8 feet away when they lift that lid. You'll smell them.
All right. Well, thank you so much, David.
All right. Thanks, guys.
That was David West. He is the wild mushroom forager for the farmers markets. He's bringing down whatever he can, but it's getting harder and harder. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We'll continue our coverage of the drought later on in today's show. Meanwhile, check out the Good Food blog for a recipe for Amelia Saltzman's roasted cauliflower three ways. It's all at kcrw.com/goodfood. We've been following the California drought each week on Good Food, and today we turn to Glenda Humiston, USDA Director of Rural Development in California, for a snapshot of how these stubborn weather patterns will affect the economy in the California Central Valley. Hi, Glenda.
Hi there.
So, in thinking about the drought, I started to think about how that meant that farmers are not going to be planting as much as they might in a normal year because they won't have the water allocations. And if they're not going to plant, that means all these farm workers aren't going to have anything to do.
That's basically correct. We've seen this in past droughts, and it's one reason we're trying to get a little bit ahead of the problem this year with working closely with community facilities and our food banks and others to prepare a little better than we have in the past.
From past experience, how much dislocation in the labor market do you think there could be? How many people might be out of jobs? Are we talking about hundreds of people, thousands of people?
You're talking thousands and actually probably tens of thousands. Because it's not just the direct farm worker themselves, but it's all the businesses that those farm workers won't be spending money at. It's all of those businesses that those farmers themselves won't be spending money at. And the effect just, it's like dropping a stone in the water. It just ripples out further and further.
So in preparing for this situation, what happens? Is there going to be some sort of engagement of new federal resources to bring additional food donation to these counties?
There's federal action on several levels. First of all, just trying to deal with not just food but water. As you may have seen, there was an article recently about 17 communities that are going to lose access to water within the next 2 to 3 months. We're working very closely with those communities with our emergency water programs to help them get access to water. We're also working with the ag community to try to see if we can get water to livestock and other crucial needs in the short term, although folks are cutting herds all over the state. We're working with the food banks to try to make sure that there's adequate storage so that they can actually receive and store and handle food. Well, one of the biggest problems previously was a lack of storage. It wasn't necessarily a lack of the food itself. So this time we're getting rather creative in trying to find more storage for that and also more facilities scattered around in a distributed fashion to make the distribution easier as well.
So let's go back to the issue of workers who are unemployed. That you're predicting will be unemployed in great numbers just at a moment when the Farm Bill, cutting $8 billion over the next several years, is cutting SNAP benefits quite dramatically.
It is, but that won't have quite the horrible effect that some people are anticipating because as these folks do lose jobs, they become eligible for SNAP. The benefits, the loss of numbers that you're seeing in the national media right now reflect how the program eligibility has been tightened up. But that doesn't mean that people aren't still eligible. In fact, even right now under the stricter standards, we have counties in the San Joaquin Valley where 30 to 40% of the people who are eligible for food stamps don't avail themselves of it. Our bigger issue is not what happened in the farm bill just now. It's actually getting people to be aware of the benefits, to take advantage of them, and then to make sure that the places are working with them to actually get healthy food to them.
It's just so strange that people who are one day out in fields picking huge amounts of produce, the next day are standing in line at a food pantry to try and get their hands on some food.
And by the way, this is going to affect consumers and grocery stores, too. That's a pretty valid point people haven't been really looking at until just this last few days.
Well, I mean, it's got to be a no-brainer that food's going to get more expensive.
More expensive and just hard to get your hands on, too, let alone more expensive. California raises extremely large percentages of our fruits and vegetables and nuts. You know, there's only so much corn and soybeans a person can eat. It's the food we grow here in California that's part of a really healthy diet. And this is going to be a really huge problem just for food security nationally and internationally.
Do you have any idea what that percentage is?
It varies by crop, but, you know, some crops, we raise half of the nation's fruits and vegetables. Some of the nuts, we raise like 80 or 90% of the world's supply. It varies by crop.
So who picks up the slack? Does a state like Florida get into more row crops like lettuce and broccoli, things that I know we're sending everywhere?
Possibly, more likely, it'll be Mexico and Chile and Peru, New Zealand, other countries will be picking up a lot of it.
Wow. So that makes it a completely different paradigm for us.
Yeah, and it hurts a whole lot of other things, too, because agriculture is one of the few sectors nationally that actually has a positive trade balance. Every $1 billion of ag product we sell that we export is 8,400 jobs here in the U.S. The eight counties of the San Joaquin Valley, if they were an agricultural nation, would be the fifth largest national ag budget in the world.
That's just, you know, it's a kind.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
It is mind-blowing. It's a level of hugeness that's hard to take in.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Glenda Humiston is the USDA's Director of Rural Development in California. We've been talking about how California's drought will affect both workers, consumers, and the economy. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Thanks so much to our team, Jillian, Laryl, Sarah, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan. Thanks for listening. And don't forget those magic numbers. 1-800-600-5279. Call now to pledge or renew your support. I'll be back next week with an hour-long episode that you won't want to miss.